Mark and Vivian are real good friends, and we appreciate them and appreciate you coming. And I think this is your third time with Cross Culture. They've come and done some church history stuff with us, which has just been absolutely incredible. If you weren't at the Australian Church History Story, just blew my mind, and loved that session. Tonight, we're so glad that you're with us. Thank you. Come on, let's do it. Shall I put this over here so that, yeah, you can see that? Is that going to be okay?
Coming through. Cool. All right. I have to say, I've never used one of these before. I feel a little bit, I normally just talk really loud. That's just usually my general method. I'll just say a little bit about who I am for those of you who I don't know. I've seen a lot of you before. I know a lot of you, or I have some connection with a lot of you. So it really does kind of feel like I'm coming back to a family that I know. So that's really great, and I really appreciate the invitation to come today. For those of you who never seen me before in your life wondering who I am, name is Shelley Vivian. You can tell from my accent that I did grow up here till I was 12, and then went back to America where my parents are from and promptly lost my accent so that I could fit into the eighth grade class that I was in. And so I do sound a little bit funny. My parents were here working initially amongst the down in Brookton area, about an hour and 45 minutes from here, in a little Aboriginal church there where they first settled and then did some church planting. In fact, the church where Mark and I currently are, my dad started that church and was the first church I was a member of when I was a kid. So your life does go in circles. I teach at Rehoboth, as you all will be familiar with Rehoboth, and that's where I went to school as well when I was in primary school. My sister went there, my mom taught there, so your life really does kind of go like that sometimes. The one other thing that I will say, just for some of you that don't know me or haven't seen this aspect of me, and that is that I have essential tremors, so my hands shake. And it doesn't mean that I'm cold or nervous or recovering from, you know, alcoholism or anything. But it is just one of those genetic things that I can't do much about. I don't think about it. So if I don't think about it, can you try to not think about it either? And we'll just sort of ignore that bit of it. But I do kind of warn people because they think, oh, that poor lady, she's so scared. And I'm really, really not. Okay. So tonight we're looking at seeing the world and why a Christian worldview matters. Why does it matter that we have a Christian worldview? And I will tell you right up front that I'm not an expert on this. It's something that I have just gotten into. And sometimes that's good, isn't it? It's kind of like Christian worldview for dummies. I'm kind of like that with church history as well, church history for dummies, because I feel like if I can learn it, then, we all can learn something. So it's all good. Now, George, you told me I have to go backwards on this one, right? Okay. So, somewhere in there? No. Doesn't like me, George. Try the other way. No. Where am I pointing it to? Yeah. All right, we'll see if we can do that. I like that you're really casual. I don't know. Or you pushed it, did you? You pushed the button. All right, so I'll just do the little thing for anything. All right, so a few years ago, a long time ago now, really, Mark was in seminary. He was training for the ministry, and I was teaching school. I taught fourth grade at a Christian school, and but one of the things that the school had, the seminary had, where Mark went, was that it was free for wives to go, or spouses to go, which was cool. I knew wives who got their whole master's of divinity degrees or whatever for absolutely free because their husbands were paying, so it was great. And I didn't have time to do all of that, but I did take a few classes. I took, guess what, church history, and that was all great. But I did that by myself because Mark had already taken it. Like, well, what could we go and do together at one of their night classes? So they were offering this thing called science and philosophy, or
history and philosophy of science.
Okay. And Mark goes, we could go do this one together. So as it turned out, I got really, really ill just before this class started, and I ended up in hospital, and so I was out for about 4 weeks. So by the time I showed up, I really was way behind what they were doing. Now, thankfully, I wasn't doing it for credit. I was just what they call auditing it. So that was good. And they had these two people, actually, who were teaching this class, Dr. Collins and Dr. Meek. And when I started coming, I was confronted by this really startling truth. I was stupid. I had graduated from high school. I graduated from college, and I'd done pretty well. But there I sat in this class, now pretty much confirmed in my belief that actually I was pretty dumb after all. And I had no idea what this class was about. And the terms that they used, they were just kind of beyond me. I began this 12-week program of highly advanced doodling in class. And, you know, I got really good at that. And the class was obviously, by its name, really heavily philosophical. And that was great for the neighbor that lived close to us who had been a philosophy major in college. But, you know, I had been a primary education major in college, and I just taught fourth grade. You know, that was... So mostly I came away from the class thinking, okay, well, I can see that there are many things about which I know nothing, and I'm pretty ignorant. But since I'm just a fourth grade teacher, it's not going to matter too much because I'm just here to teach my level, you know. So just let me get back to my regular kind of fourth grade stuff. And things went on. So I was sort of aware of my ignorance, but kind of figured I couldn't do much about it. Sorry. Are we ready to click? Just on the right. That one or that one? There we go. So it's this one? All right. So this is kind of what it felt like to me going to this class, just sitting there with a whole lot of gobbledygook that I really, really couldn't understand. Well, then a few years later, Mark got a job, and we were in this church, and in America they have adult Sunday school, which sounds very strange, but basically it's great because you can kind of have these classes where you could be taught as well. So I took this class. And we were reading this book called How Now Shall We Live? Some of you may have heard of it before. It's by Chuck Colson and a woman named Nancy Piercy. And Colson is just an amazing storyteller. So when I'm reading this book, which is pretty, you know, it's pretty thick. I felt pretty good about reading this really thick book. But basically, it seemed like I was just reading these stories, and I just almost couldn't put it down. And by the end of reading this book, I realized that pretty much what I was reading was the same kind of stuff that had been in this, you know, totally incomprehensible class that I had taken, and I was introduced to the idea of worldview. And I thought, wow, that's really something. Now, it's not that I didn't have a pretty decent idea of, you know, Christian ideas. I grew up in a Christian home. I went to a Christian high school. You know, we had good Christian discussions around the dinner table, pretty good deep ones. I went to a Christian college. And now I was teaching at a school where we were very clear on the idea that everything that is true is something that belongs to God. And so all areas of life have value for that reason. But this book was something of a revelation to me. And not only that, it convinced me that I shouldn't stay dumb. I actually should learn something about these ideas of worldview. So, it is going back. I'm pushing the right one, I think. You're just gonna have to do the next one, right? And click again. So, worldview basically is the framework of your beliefs through which you view the world. That sounds pretty obvious. And your place in it. And it answers a bunch of questions about what the nature of the universe is, and what a human being is, how we can know things, what makes something right or wrong, what our purpose on earth is. All of these kinds of big questions frame the basis on which people view the world and how they're answered those kind of questions. Now look, there are some people who really know what their worldview is. You ask Richard Dawkins, part of the New Atheist set, and he will be very clear about what his worldview is. He's going to tell you, he's going to know exactly what it is. But probably your average Joe or Josephine walking down the street hasn't thought too much about how they answer all those questions, and if you said to them, what's your worldview, they might not have that much of an idea. However, your worldview matters. And there's lots of reasons why we should learn about Christian worldview and how it compares and contrasts. Poor George. All right, so why learn about worldview? reason number one, Christianity is no longer the prevailing worldview. Secularism has gone global. There is no longer a moral consensus. So in the West, we've been in this kind of unusual historical position of sort of having Christianity as the predominant worldview for quite a long time, kind of unnaturally so, if you like, because if you were to go around the world, that certainly wouldn't be the case. And believe it or not, that is not the way that the world has usually worked. But now more and more, the prevailing worldview in the West seems to be a secular naturalism that kind of flows out of the thinking of people like Charles Darwin and people in his vein. We don't have a consensus anymore that is clear on what's right or what's wrong. In fact, we're not really sure anymore that there really is a right or a wrong. Well, some people are sure. They say that there isn't any way to know that there's a right or wrong. That's what they're sure of. So we can't speak to people in the same way that we used to be able to. They're not thinking the way that they might have once long time ago. All right, next one. Ideas penetrate our mind subtly through education, media, books, etc., and ignoring them is not going to make them go away. If we're not aware what worldviews are being taught through these kind of more subtle methods, well, we're going to be influenced by them way more than we realize. And it isn't enough to just say, all right, well, we will just not read any non-Christian books, and we will just not read any non-Christian, or watch any non-Christian movies, and we're definitely not going to read Harry Potter, right? Where we sort of isolate ourselves, and we kind of think that by doing that, you know, if I just put my blinders on, it'll all be better. Stick my head in the sand, and it'll all go away. Fact is, we can't help but be confronted by an alternate worldview and be influenced by them, especially if we don't recognize them for what they are. All right, next reason. Like the early church, we need to be prepared to engage the culture so that it can be changed, to be missionaries, if you like, to the culture. If you go to a new culture, what do you have to do? You have to learn it, don't you? You have to learn the language first off, don't you, before you can start communicating. You've got to know what that culture is like so that you can start figuring out how to effectively minister in it. And that's what the early church did. They were a completely different worldview from the Roman pagan culture that existed around them. And they learned what was going on around them, and they saw it as their task to understand it, engage it, so that they could be, in effect, missionaries to it. And we're in a similar situation, more and more, where we are the odd ones out, and we have to learn our culture so that we can show them Jesus, really. Okay, next one. Some people would say, well, can't we just stick to the simple gospel? All this worldview stuff sounds really highfalutin. Is that a term they use in Australia? Highfalutin? You kind of get the idea, right? So let's just stick to the simple gospel. Well, the simple gospel is not simple to those whose worldview prevents them from understanding it. It's not simple. You know, the problem is that those around us don't have the understanding of the gospel. Even the vocabulary that we so often use, you know, ask the Lord into your heart. What does that mean? You've got to be born again, you know. Just let go and let God. I don't know what it might be for you. But they don't know those kinds of terms. They haven't grown up with it. And until we have a grasp of where they're coming from, we're going to be speaking a foreign language to them. So the simple gospel is not going to be simple for them. It's actually incomprehensible. The next one, last one for now. We and our children need to be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks. That's 1 Peter 3:15. Most of you will know that passage. Our children are going to ask the hard questions. Maybe you've already had your kids ask me, well, how does it work? It says in the Bible this, but what I'm learning in school is this. How does that get reconciled? And too often we say, well, you know, you just have to have a little more faith, or it's a matter of faith. And we don't really address their actual questions. And they wander away saying, well, really, these other people seem to have more answers than the Christians do. I've got to be able to reconcile my faith with the seeming facts that are out there. How does that work without when our faith seems to contradict it? It's not going to be helpful to just give them shove to the side kinds of answers. All right, so it matters that we understand our own worldview as well as the ones that we're going to encounter. But the more steeped in the prevailing worldview that we are, the more difficult it's going to be to unlearn it, right, to change our thinking. I'm not a brain chemist. I'm not a chemist at all. I teach, you know, primary school kids, so I'm just telling you that right now. I'm not a neuroscientist, but it seems pretty clear that once you've learned a thing, it's very difficult to learn it a different way. So just click the button and we'll play the... it might not be connected to sound. That's the only thing. I forgot about this bit. Not connected to sound, is it? All right. Well, we won't watch this one. I will... It's actually a very cool video, but basically this guy has this bike. You can just see the essence of it. But he's an engineer, and his team changed one thing on his bike. It was that when you turned the handle this way, the tire went that way. And when you turned it this way, the tire went that way. You can at least watch it. Should click. No? No? Oh. What happened? Going back through. Not going to do it. All right, I'm sorry. Anyway, he thought, well, I know the principle, right? I know that if I turn it this way, that will go that way. So knowing that, I should be able to ride this bike. No. And in every circumstance where he's tried it out with someone, he's offered them $100, right? Here's $100, $200. You ride 10 feet, and I'll give you this $200. They can't do it. Because we have learned something. We have something geared in our brain a certain way. And even knowing something doesn't really help us to change the algorithm in our brain. So it's very difficult to unlearn something. We've got to change the way that we think. All right, go ahead, and we'll just go to the next one. All right, so I'd imagine that for most of us here, if you're coming out on a Sunday night, you know, you would say that we are the ones who have a Christian worldview, and we want that. We desire it, certainly, don't we? Or we wouldn't be here. But the more that we delve into our own thinking, the more we understand that the beliefs that we say, the stated beliefs, our statement of beliefs, don't always line up with the beliefs that are actually controlling us. Because it's what's underneath. The actual decisions we make show what we really believe, don't we? Doesn't it? All right. Well, next one there, George. Thanks. My sister Shannon started dating Carlton, who became my brother-in-law, while she was in college. And he came over to our house. He stayed with us for a few days just before they went back to college. And we were eating breakfast one morning, and he stood up and he said, I believe I'll have another glass of orange juice. And we issued this sort of collective gasp. And he looked at us, and because Carlton kind of likes to psychoanalyze us anyway, he was trying to figure out why we were all so shocked about this idea that that he would have a second glass of orange juice. Because we realized we never, never got a second glass of orange juice at breakfast. A little bit more psychoanalysis, you know, went on. And we discovered that the reason that we never had a second glass of orange juice was because I grew up here in Australia, and in my backyard, there was an orange tree. And if you're going to have orange juice in the morning, someone had to go and pick the oranges and hand squeeze the orange. It was usually my dad. So you had the glass of orange juice that he made for you, and you did not expect any more, because to do that would be to have to go pick more oranges, more squeezing, you know. And so, you know, my whole life, we only drank one glass of orange juice, and we never got the second glass. And even though we no longer had an orange tree in our backyard, and we had a perfectly good bottle of orange juice sitting in the fridge, for us, you know, for the Crosses, the way the world worked was you had one glass of orange juice. And, you know, we had never thought about it before, but you know what? Thinking about our thinking helped us to make some changes as to what we did. I now feel quite comfortable going and getting a second glass of orange juice if I want it, because I don't have to squeeze it, all right? This is true. Just hold up your fingers, 2, 3, you know, heard it before. All right. Okay, well, Nancy Piercy, go ahead, George, thanks. Nancy Piercy, in her book Total Truth, tells us that a worldview has its purpose, as its purpose, to explain our experiences of the world. So the success of that worldview philosophy is going to be judged based on how well it does that, how well it actually explains the way that the world seems to work. For a worldview to be workable, it has to express the realities of our existence. It has to hold through has to hold true through to a logical conclusion. All right. Now, I'm not a logician, and really my brain starts exploding sometimes. So if I get like you're just going, whoa, back up, please let me know, and I'm happy to back up a little bit. All right. In other words, I've got to be able to live out my worldview. It's got to work. Okay, that's going to judge whether it's successful or not. Okay, so where do we get our worldview from? And you're just going to have to click a couple of times here. Well, these ones would be ones you would come up with, right? Family, education, culture, media, that's it, thanks. Culture, the media, and our experiences. You know, all of these experiences, too, help us to determine how the world works. I mean, for the crosses, it was one glass of orange juice. You know, it works for everything from you shouldn't touch hot irons, you learn that pretty young, to friends are not always friends forever, right? So we gather this information about our worldview through a whole lot of sources. Our parents tell us this is how the world works. The world, through the media, through our education, tells us this is how the world works. Where we grew up is going to influence that. And these influences can be really obvious and deliberate. You know, it can be us sitting around the table with our children having devotions with them. That is you communicating a worldview to your children. Or when a philosophy lecturer instructs his class. That's very obviously conveying a worldview to his students. Yesterday I heard an ad for the plebiscite that's coming up and telling people that they needed to register for it. And they said, this is a society of free speech, so we don't want to tell you in any way how you should vote. But here at Radio XYZ, we believe that, and it was a pretty obvious, clear statement of worldview that they were saying. So some of them we think of subtle, but perhaps they're not all as subtle as all of that. Take a look at this next one. Berenstain Bears, a very popular children's book that came out, it's been out for decades now. Anyone ever see the Berenstain Bears before? Oh yeah, you know, Mama and Papa and the kitty bears, they go off on these little adventures and they learn all kinds of stuff. All right, this one is called The Bear's Nature Guide. All right, and in this episode, the father bear is explaining nature. And so it's a bit hard to read, but as he goes on, he tells us, nature is you, nature is me. Nature, it's all that is or was or ever will be. Sounds remarkably like Revelation 1 verse 8, which says, I am the Alpha and the Omega, says the Lord God, who is and who was and who is to come, the Almighty. But it's actually a direct quote, not from the Bible, obviously, but from this guy. Next, Carl Sagan, who was a cosmologist, very popular on television over the years, who used this phrase about the cosmos very directly. The cosmos is all that is and all that was and all that ever will be. And that is conveyed directly in that children's book that we read to our kids very innocently. I got on Amazon and I looked at all the reviews and it was just like heralding how wonderful their memories were of reading this book from the 1970s to their children. Carl Sagan, his son said, my father believed in the goddess Spinoza and Einstein, God not behind nature, but as nature, equivalent to it. And we can see that in there, can't we? And we see this expressed in children's books. So these worldviews are coming through somewhat subtly, but when we're looking for them, wow, we can really see them, can't we? All right, so next one. In its simplest terms, your worldview is going to be expressed by how you answer these questions. Now, I gave you a whole list, but I'm going to break it down to three. These are the most simple ones. And the first one is a bit hard to see. Sorry, it's small from there. I'll just read them for you. Where did we come from? And who are we? What has gone wrong with the world? And what can we do to fix it? So we express that as the world's view position on what we would say creation, fall, and redemption. Now, those are Christian terms that we might be familiar with, but they're the basic ideas for every worldview. Every worldview has the answer to those questions. Let me just show you very quickly with three. Do the next slide. Here's Buddhism and New Age pantheism. That is just Carl Sagan's view, really, that God is in nature and nature is God and all that kind of thing. Okay. My next door neighbors are Buddhists, and they have this kind of wording all the time. Their idea of creation, of where we've come from, is that the origin of all things and ultimate reality is the absolute, the one, a universal spiritual essence that's out there. Very difficult to bring comfort to my next door neighbor when her daughter died at age 19 of cancer, if this is what you think is out there for her. What's gone wrong with the world, with the source of evil and suffering, is our sense of individuality. If you could just release yourself from that. So the solution, the redemption part, our problems will be solved as we reunite with the universal spiritual essence from which we all came. And for our next door neighbor, Moksha, when she died, they just hoped that she would come back in a better life and eventually she would reach nirvana. That's one. Next one, Marxism. Creation? Well, the ultimate origin of everything is self-creating, self-generating matter. Everything makes itself. In other words, it's just sort of created by itself. There's nothing behind it. So what's the problem? Well, in a Marxist view, the sin, if you like, the fall, is the rise of private property. It's an economic philosophy. And you can see, you kind of go, well, that doesn't sound really religious, does it? But in all of these, there is an idol behind it. And I just want to point your attention as I'm going through this to Romans chapter 1, because Romans chapter 1 is the worldview explainer, if you like. And I'll just read you some of this. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. So it has to do with truth. This is the big question. It's a worldview, isn't it? For what can be known about God is plain to them because God's shown it to them. His invisible attributes, his eternal power, his divine nature have been clearly seen ever since the creation of the world and the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they didn't honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking and their foolish hearts were darkened. They suppressed that truth. Claiming to be wise, they became fools. Exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. They have exchanged the creation for the creator for the creation. And they've made matter their idol, material stuff their idol. And so it becomes materialism, naturalism. In every one of these worldviews, there's an idol to be found. It might not be a statue. It might not be something you can go to a shrine for. But there's something that they have exchanged the truth of God for the lie. So their idea of redemption then is revolution, overthrow all of this, and you'll get the back to primitive communism. All right, one more. This new militant atheism that is the atheism of Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens and others in his like. I think Christopher Hitchens has now discovered the truth since he's died. But it is very sad, isn't it, though, isn't it? Yeah. Creation for an atheist is, again, very similar to a Marxist. Self-originating universe, natural selection, account for everything. I can explain away everything that's here because it's just all sort of self-generated. The fall, the sin that's in the world, is caused by this irrational thinking and dangerous behavior brought on by religious systems. And so if we could just get rid of all religion and debunk it and realize that our purpose in life is just to exist, then all would be well. However, in all of these systems, you will hear the phrase, as if. I have to live as if something were true, even though I don't believe it's true. And that really does let us know. They all believe that these things somehow, they don't always all fit together, but they want it to work because they don't want the Creator God. So, is Christianity then just kind of one more worldview in the smorgasbord of worldviews? I can have a little Buddhism, have a little militant atheism, have a little bit of this. Do I just pick Christianity as one of them that's out there? What makes Christianity any different from any of these? So let's take a look at what Christianity says in answer to the questions. And please keep an eye on the time for me, would you, so I don't talk too long. All right. So we're going to look at these same questions for Christianity. What does a Christian worldview say? All right, well, first of all, it's important to recognize that the Bible, it tells us a whole complete story. It tells it from beginning, eternity past, to eternity future. It gives meaning to life, past, present, and future, and it's this meta-narrative. Love these big words, you know. Have to run and look in a dictionary somewhere, but basically big story, okay? It tells the big story of how the world fits and how it all works together. Okay, so let's take a look. How do we get here? Why are we here? What's human? Right? What does the Bible have to say about that creation idea? Well, it says the creation is put here, created by God, out of nothing. There was no matter that existed, and then God spoke, and there was. That's how the Bible explains it. What about us? Well, we are created with a purpose. We are here to glorify God. We're here to enjoy Him, to have a relationship with Him. We've been created with work to do. We're to subdue and fill the earth, have dominion, to do God's work after Him, to think God's thoughts after Him. That's our work. And we're created with dignity because we've been created like God to reflect Him in this world so that when people look at us, they should get an idea of what God is like from looking at us. That gives us real purpose, doesn't it? It fulfills that idea of why we are here. All right, what's gone wrong with the world? Next slide. What's gone wrong? Well, man has sinned. They tried to put themselves in the place of God. And it radically affected all areas of life. And it wasn't just for Adam and Eve, and it wasn't just that sometimes they would get sick, but every area of life has been affected. God's good creation has been distorted, not destroyed, but distorted. Man cannot, on his own, find his way back to God because of sin. That's what's wrong with the world. It's our relationship with God has gone wrong. All right? What are we going to do? What's the solution? Wow, that is really small from there. Sorry. Jesus, God's Son, was perfectly obedient on our behalf. He paid the penalty of our sin, conquered sin and death through His resurrection. Those who believe in Christ are given His righteousness, and now we are free to live out our original purpose, bringing restoration to a fallen world. And Jesus' return will bring full restoration to this world. That's the solution. Both that in between the time that before Jesus comes back, we are here to continue doing what God gave us to do from creation on, which is to rule and have dominion over this world and to create culture and to improve it and to leave it better than we found it and to bring restoration to a broken world, to find those that are broken and help to bind the wounds. And someday Jesus will come back and it will be made perfect again. Isn't that just such a... I'm sorry, but I get goosebumps when I say that even, because that gives us such hope, doesn't it? Such purpose in life. It isn't just that I'm going to try to do something that will kind of have meaning, you know, maybe when I die, they might remember me for the next 100 and 200 years, but, you know, eventually this whole world will just blow up because the stars or planets or whatever will go, and then nobody will remember me. No. The work that we do here lasts into eternity. Isn't that such a blessing? Well, most of you will just say, well, isn't that just the simple gospel that we were talking about earlier? Yeah, that's exactly what it is. It's the simple gospel, but it's also a unique worldview that's really unlike any other because it fits everything together. It explains everything. There is a unity to it. And this Christian worldview actually did change the way that the Western world viewed mankind. And so I'm going to show you just a few, and I've got to give a little hat tip to Tim Keller. I don't know if any of you have read any of Tim Keller's stuff. This is his book on preaching, which Mark handed to me to read a particular chapter, and I've read a little bit more than that. Well worth it, if not for just this chapter alone. So let's see how biblical worldview has shaped thinking. So before Christianity emerged, the body and the material world was less important and real. And we're talking about times of the Greeks and so on. After Christianity came to the West, the body and the material world were good. Improving them is important. Science is possible because of Christianity. Do you know, the Greeks really didn't get anywhere with science. They didn't see studying material things to be that important. It didn't progress until Christianity came along. What else? Before Christianity emerged, history was considered cyclical, with no direction. It just sort of cycled around, repeating itself. We still have that in Buddhism. That's still their view of things. But after Christianity came to the West, we see that history has a purpose. We're doing God's work, moving forward to the time that He will come back. It runs along a line. It's not purposeless and hopeless. All right? It's the next one. Individuals are unimportant before Christianity. Only the clan and the tribe mattered. Didn't really matter what happened to you individually. But after Christianity, all individuals are important. They have dignity and deserve my help and respect. In the Roman Empire, if you had a child that you didn't want, maybe it was a girl child and you really wanted a boy, you'd put them out by the river and you'd leave them and expose them until they died. Christians were the ones who would go and rescue those children, raise them, adopt them, and raise them as their own, because they said, no, every individual life is important. And Emperor Julian, the apostate, complained, these Christians, they take care of our own people better than we do. So how on earth are we going to fight them when they seem to be doing so much more to help our own country than we do ourselves? He didn't like it, but had to admit it. All right, what else? Before, human choices don't matter. We're just fated. We have this fate, and it's deterministic. There's nothing you can do to change it. But with the rise of Christianity, we began to believe that human choices do matter. We are responsible for our actions. They have consequences. So it's important to make good choices. All right? One more. Before, emotions and feelings should not be explored. They should only be, sort of overcome. We don't deal with that part of our personality. We don't deal with that part of our person. Christians said, no, emotions and feelings have been given to us by God. They're good. And they're important. They should be understood and they should be directed. So all of these aspects have changed Western man. Now, this sounds pretty good, doesn't it? You might say, I can see how that's happened. I can see how we have a better view of the individual person now. Yep, that sounds right. And these are things we cherish in our society today. So what's the big deal? What's the problem? Well, each of these ideas stem from the fact that Christianity holds to a loving, personal creator God who has a relationship with individuals. But in today's increasingly secular, materialistic, naturalistic world, we've taken those same ideas that individuals are important, they matter, human decisions matter, so on, and we've made them into these absolutes, but we've cut them off at the root. Because the root of all of those ideas are based on who is God. What is God and what has he done in this world and what has he made us to be? But if you cut the tree off and you try to take the ideas but you strike away the root, that's what we've got today. So history is moving along forward, and so every day we're better than they were in the past. But we don't see it as moving towards the purpose that God has planned for us. So you can start to see some of the problems. Interestingly, secular naturalism is the most impersonal philosophy that's out there. I mean, if I believe that, then there's nothing in an individual that really distinguishes him from a rock, right? Because we're just a bunch of atoms that have somehow formed into the thing that it is, some chance matter coming together. So logically, there's really no reason to give any person dignity in their worldview, or to consider their emotions or any of that. But like all non-biblical worldviews, people find they can't live consistently with the implications of their philosophy. You often find them saying that they have to live, as I mentioned before, as if moral ideas were true, for instance, because when it comes to it, they still don't want their house robbed. Right? So if you followed it to the conclusion, you'd say, well, what difference does it make? There's nothing wrong. They chose to do something. But we still don't like it, do we? Because there is something in us that says there is a right and there's a wrong. So how about us? Do we live consistently with the worldview that we claim to hold, or are we consistently inconsistent? Which I think we often are, right? Well, where is it that we fall down? Let's go ahead into the next one. Because the Bible teaches that God is the creator of all things, it means that all that is a part of this world, seen and unseen, is his truth. Everything I can see and everything that I can't see belongs to God. We believe that there's not only the observable truth of this physical world, but that there's the moral truth that exists because of his character. Right? It is true that stealing is wrong because that is based on the character of God. But like those other worldviews, we tend to separate out this world into two truths. That of the so-called sacred world, you know, those things we say belong to God. It's a bit hard to see there, but anything moral, and you know, saying grace, having faith, ethics, missions, theology, evangelism, you know, Sundays. There's that part, that's the spiritual truth. And then there's the everyday kind of truth, right? Those the things that belong to this world. And we do that in kind of big and small ways. Sometimes it's the time that we put into one or the other that tells us whether we think one is more important. Or it's in thinking that we might have a public face that we go to work with, but then our Christian side is that kind of private faith that sort of stays within us. And whenever we think that our faith doesn't really intersect with the real world, we've made this false dichotomy, this false split, that God is only God of one part of reality. And so we've taken on that on board as well. Well, where does this come from? All right, you ready for a little bit of history? Is that all right? Can I go into a little bit? All right. Where does this come from? All right, there's a few clicks through here, George, so you just have to follow me. All right, so there's these Greek guys, right? Plato and Aristotle. Here they are. And I've stolen this right out of Rubens' painting, School of Athens. And they separated this world into this dualism. So Plato, he's the guy that's pointing up, said that the world is composed of matter and forms, right? That there's kind of this raw material, and it's organized by these sort of rational ideas, right? If your head's exploding now, that's perfectly all right. And the matter, the stuff that we see here in this world, is eternal, but it's inferior, and it's sort of chaotic, and it didn't conform to any rules, so the creator couldn't really control it. It was sort of outside the creator. True reality, he claimed, were in the ideal forms, you know, so it's kind of like we get fascinated with watching a shadow puppet show on the wall, but the real stuff is the stuff that's behind it, you see. That's what he would have said. Well, early church took some of Plato's ideas and what we call Neoplatonism, and they tried to, the Calvin and Hobbes word is transmogrify it into Christianity, and so it resulted in this belief that there's a Christian practice of sort of the stuff that's good that's up here, and then the stuff that's not so good down here. And it resulted in this idea that, you know, those people that worked in this spiritual realm, like monks, you know, they were better. And then the people, you know, had to do things like farming. Well, they worked with the material stuff, and that was evil. So they're not as good. So, and marriage as a physical act. Yep, we can add that next one in there. Marriage as a physical act, well, that was sort of less good than those people who abstained from that kind of thing. And so what they did was that they took God's created stuff that he had made good and declared it to be bad. They said creation actually, like the Greeks would have said, the material stuff is actually not good. But God said it is good when he made it. So more and more the spiritual and the secular were separated. Then along comes our next guy, Aristotle. And you see that, you saw Plato was pointing up, right? The upper stuff is the stuff that matters, these ideal realms. And Aristotle is going like this. No, that the things here on earth, the nature of a thing, what it was destined to become, you know, like an acorn is going to become a tree, you know, a big oak tree. That was good. And all the processes associated with that thing was good. So you can see he's going, no, actually this stuff is not so bad. This earthly stuff is not too bad. Well, years went by, and then this guy, next one, named Thomas Aquinas came along. And he's kind of Middle Ages kind of guy, and he just rediscovers Aristotle's work. And he's trying to retain this kind of this two-story idea, you know, it's good on the top, bad on the bottom. But he liked this idea of Aristotle that the nature or the purpose of things were sort of inherent, just like that oak, that acorn inherently in it is destined to be an oak tree, right? That's the nature of it. It's kind of inherent purpose. And so he looked at it in ourselves. And he said, that's true for us. We have something purposeful in us. And he sort of removed the idea that the earthly was bad, so that was a good move. in saying, yes, the created world has been made by a good God, and so he restored dignity to that. But he had a problem. There's a flaw in what he was thinking, because if what I have been designed for is inherent in me, what do I need God for? I'm going to become what I'm going to become, and it's sort of the nature of it, and it's a natural process. I can reason that. Now, what he did, go ahead, you can put it up there, is he added sort of an upper story that he called grace. So he called the lower bit my nature. I can reach my nature or my goal by my own resources, right? But if I really want to reach a relationship with God, well, then I need something supernatural added on. And he called it grace to the sort of upper story. And it's his supernatural add-on that gives me extra power to know God. You know, us ordinary people are only capable of reaching our earthly goals. So the farmer went along and he reached his earthly goal of becoming the farmer. Well, the religious elites can sort of reach these heavenly purposes. And he talked about earthly purposes and heavenly purposes. But still, it became like the icing on a cake, you know. They operate as two independent substances. And it divided human nature in half and separated it. Okay, so by the time we get to the, go ahead on the next one, we get to the scientific revolution around the time of the Enlightenment. In the 1600s and beyond. And truth became more and more only those things that I can observe through the scientific process. And since, coming out of Aquinas, my reason is more than capable of observing and dealing with all the things that I see, it's all really I need, isn't it? Well, that's all I need. If that's what truth is, only what I can observe, I can do that myself. I don't need God for that. That's all that's in. And since I can't observe love, you know, I can't say, here you go, that's love, or this is goodness, okay, or beauty, then those things are no longer truth in the same category. So they elevated what we call empirical science. Empiricism is that idea that what's true is really only those things I can observe with my senses, what I can see, hear, taste, touch, smell, right? That's the only thing that's real. All knowledge is derived from the senses. And since you can't derive moral truth from the senses, I can't sniff out right from wrong, then that's not really true truth, you see. So there's different kinds of truth. All right. Then we got this guy, David Hume of the hats. As I present him to my students, I love David Hume's hats. And David Hume was a radical empiricist. He really did believe that everything you can know only comes through your senses. I wish someone had told him that his hats didn't work for him, but that's okay. And he says, if knowledge is based ultimately on sensations, my senses, in other words, then morality too has got to come out of my senses. So if something gives me pleasure, then it makes that thing good. If something gives me pain, that thing is bad. And so morality becomes a question not of something being true based on the character of God, which had been the thinking for a long time, but based on what I feel. This is good for me because this is what feels good. What's good for you might be different. Do you see how we get to where we are? All right. Time for Calvin and Hobbes. Calvin and Hobbes do ontology, which is that's how we know the nature of being, right? Got to love these words on things like ontology. Y'all read Calvin and Hobbes? The greatest philosophers ever, right? If you want to know about philosophy, just read a little Calvin and Hobbes. There is a Calvin and Hobbes cartoon for just about every philosophical discussion you can have. Well, here Calvin says, we rely on sight to confirm the existence of things. We don't believe in the things we can't see. That's empiricism. So how do we know that no-see-ums exist? Now, in America, we have these little bugs you can't really see. We call them no-see-ums because you can kind of tell that they're there, but you can't, you know, and you're sitting there going, and it looks like someone's just frantically waving. We call them no-see-ums. All right, so how do we know that no-see-ums exist? Verification is ruled out by definition. It's an ontological quandary. And Hobbes says, hold still a minute. Ooh, I itch. Glad I could help. In other words, the proof of it is more than just what you could see, isn't it? How do you know something is true? Well, it's more than just what I can see. So Calvin and Hobbes also do ontology, a little bit of philosophy there. All right. Thus, we've come to the point of new dualisms. Go ahead there, George. Ones in which we've managed to remove God to the outer fringes, to place fact in that lower... I'll go ahead and do the next two. Sorry, I forgot I had them in out of order. So I can have fact in that lower idea, those things that we can verify with our senses, even though, you know, our senses have played us false quite often. The things that we think are true go down a few years and someone goes, actually, no, that wasn't true at all. So we have this publicly verifiable fact and values which are only a construct of society, what society values, not based on truth. It's perfectly changeable, subject to change as our society changes. And we've placed religion up there too. Since morals have no basis in fact, they would argue, we put that into the private sphere, not one that should influence things like public education and politics or art or media. And certainly not my preferences. Right. So I put it on this outer fringes. And the way that most of Christianity has been dealt with is to say, yeah, that's nice for you, honey. But it's really not fact. That's a faith thing. Off you go with your faith thing. But that's purely private. So you can see that that easily becomes adopted even by those who would claim to have a Christian mindset. Now, Martin Luther King Jr., who's the much loved and often revered leader of the civil rights movement, Christian minister, who clearly says, he says science deals mainly with facts, religion deals mainly with values. So you can see that's the way that he's adopted that. That's on one side and that's on the other. And don't let the two mix. All right, but God, here we go, we can go now. Thanks, George. The Bible claims that God is the author of all wisdom, not just the private faith that we should sort of keep to ourselves. Look at what Psalm 11:10 says. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, all wisdom, not just some sort of spiritual wisdom. Colossians 2:3. By the way, Colossians 2:3 is the other worldview book. Wow, that one, read that through. It'll help your worldview. In whom, it says Christ, in whom are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge, not only spiritual knowledge. The Bible claims a comprehensive view of truth. There's a unity of truth. One that embraces the whole person as we love God, not just with our hearts, but what else? Our minds and souls and strength. Our minds. And this is actively marginalizing Christians who are told to stay out of the public realm, whether it's government policy or public education. Just keep your faith to yourself. It's not true for anybody but you. So, why should we care about worldview? Thanks, George. Paul reminds us, we're not to be conformed to this world. Example, we're not to feel that our faith should be kept private as though it's a second-class truth. To feel that there's no connect between the facts of science and the moral feelings, and to be embarrassed about it. We shouldn't be conformed to this world. Instead, we're to be transformed, radically changed, in the renewing of our mind. Our minds are to be active and engaged. Shouldn't be like me when I first sat in that class and went, oh, it's all too much, really. It's all too hard. Just let me get on with the job of teaching fourth grade. What I didn't understand was if I didn't get this, I was going to be teaching my fourth grade or something I didn't want them to know. Be transformed by the renewing of your minds. We're to discern so that by testing you may discern, thinking, actively thinking and delving deep, what is the will of God, that good and perfect, acceptable will of God, to see his truth in every aspect and venue and arena of life. That's what's good and perfect. I'll just finish with this. There's this guy named August Landmesser. Some of you might have seen this picture before. Can you see what all these people are doing? What does it look like they're doing? The Nazi salute. This was taken at a shipyard in 1936, I want to say. August Landmesser was a worker at the shipyard. And you can see where it's circled. There's a man there. If you look closely, he's standing like this. August Landmesser was a man who wanted to marry a woman who was Jewish. And he had applied for for a marriage license, and it had been revoked, or it had been denied because she was Jewish. They secretly married, had two children together. Secretly married, they sort of common law marriage, if you like. His wife would later be arrested, sent to a variety of concentration camps, eventually being killed at the Barenburg Euthanasia Center near the Ravensbrück concentration camp. Same concentration camp that Corrie ten Boom, if you're familiar with the story, the hiding place where she was being held. Landmesser himself would eventually be detained and finally sent on in an army unit that was a penal army unit. They were prisoners basically sent to fight for the Germans. He died in action in Croatia. Landmesser looked at the worldview of his day, which proclaimed the facts of eugenics, the scientific facts of racial purity, and he saw that it didn't fit with the unity of truth that was borne out in his own experience, and he remained unconformed. I want us to be encouraged to look carefully at ourselves, the things we say we believe, and ask God to show us where we're inconsistent with the unity of the truth proclaimed in God's word. Help us to be transformed so that we'll discern the will of God. I'm just going to finish by showing you a few books. Hope that's all right. I'm always up for showing a few books. I hope you like to read. I think there's a slide there, George. Yeah. Pretty much, you'll see that there's three books by one lady. and I like it that here's a lady that I can admire here. Her name is Nancy Piercy. I mentioned her earlier. I've got two of them here. Total Truth, which was the first one I read by her, goes through a lot of those ideas. And let me tell you that these are not easy reading books in a lot of ways, but boy, it will make you think. Looking at cultural captivity, this one, if you like art and music and literature, she examines the worldviews behind so much of the art that we see. It's called Saving Leonardo. Some of the ideas, of course, are repeated because these things are just ideas that are there. But that one's excellent. Also, one there that I don't have to show you because it's on my Kindle is Finding Truth, where she examines the idols and how you can find the idols in each of the worldviews that are there using Romans 1. And she goes through that. Those are excellent resources. The one I told you about at the beginning that I read that was so instrumental for me is How Now Shall We Live by Charles Colson. Nancy Piercy is a co-author in that. Nothing else, read it for the stories that he writes. They're so great. This is probably the first place I would go with worldview. If you've never read anything before, it looks thick and scary, but the stories themselves are great. The one that I mentioned earlier is Preaching by Tim Keller. Find out whether your preaching is all good happening here. there you go, Mark. I know he's read it, so you're all good. But there's a great chapter in here where he teases out those ideas about how Christianity has changed the world, and that one is great. And the one that I'm most scared about reading, and I'm starting on it, and I've just sort of avoided it because I was just sort of scared, really. And it's the thinnest book, and you wouldn't think, but it's The God Who Is There by Francis Schaeffer, sort of the one who influenced Nancy Piercy so much in her walk as the late theologian Francis Schaeffer, where he shows this two-story view of truth and how it's come about. I've started reading it, and you have to read slowly, but I think I can do it. So I'm going. So those are my book recommendations. Thanks very much for listening tonight. I hope it's been encouraging. I like growing up and learning a little bit more than I did before. So thanks very much.